Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. As you remember, our podcast is dedicated to the discussion of recent publications in the field of Russian and Eurasian Studies, and today I'm going to be talking to Julie Wilhelmsen, who is a Senior Research Fellow at the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. Julie will be talking about her recent book called Russia's Securitization of Chechnya, How War Became Acceptable.
So it is my pleasure to introduce Julie Wilhelmsen, the author of Russia's Securitization of Chechnya. Hello, Julie.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. The winter in Norway is heavy, but I'm surviving it.
You know, we're having a snow blizzard today in Boston.
Really? Well, that's a usual thing here.
I hope it's better on the other side of the Atlantic today. So we always start our conversation by asking our speaker to tell a little bit about their background and how they came to do Russian and Eurasian studies.
Yeah, so I have lived my entire life in Norway, but I grew up in kind of a collective house with many families living together and working in an international organization. My parents worked in this international organization, which used to be called the Oxford Group, then it was called Moral Rearmament, and then Initiatives of Change. And this was a very idealistic international organization working for reconciliation between countries, religions, ideologies,
and basically
very, very interesting, but also quite heavy, you know, when you're a child, basically not being able to take in the big world out there. But I think that's an important part of my background. So there were always lots of discussions about world problems, how to change the world, how you should start with yourself if you want to change the world. And in fact, quite a special focus on the Soviet Union at that time, because this organization had very many contacts with the dissident movement, particularly in Russia. So that's kind of a background where I was very young, was quite conscious of that the world is big and interesting, but also full of problems which need to be solved. Then when I finished school, I went off to work with Mother Teresa in Calcutta, basically to try to find out, you know, who am I? What do I want to do with my life? And then I concluded that I'm actually not going to be a sister of a charity, but rather go back to start university. So I did history, Russian, political science, and I also went to study language in Russia. And then since then, I've worked as a researcher at NUPI, the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, and at the Norwegian Defense Establishment, and now for the last 15 years at NUPI again. And then I'm married and I have 5 kids. So, it's a fairly intensive life and a good combination
of... It does sound very intensive.
Yeah, family life and... really a heavy engagement with understanding and explaining Russian politics, and in particular conflict and security related issues in Russia.
And how did Chechnya come into the picture?
When I did my Norwegian master's, which is more like an MPhil in the Norwegian context, I was preoccupied by trying to explain why, after the fall of the Soviet Union, a conflict emerged in Chechnya and not in Tatarstan, which was another Russian federal republic, which was fairly nationalistic, and there was a mobilization, there was a strong nationalist movement, but there was never a separatist movement. So that was my initial interest. And then I think for those of us who grew up with this image of the Soviet Union as one country, really the most interesting thing is this discovery of how complex and how many different ethnicities, religions that actually lived within the Soviet Union and how they survived. And in the Chechen case, it's a very interesting story of how there is this kind of parallel governance. You know, the Chechens live under the Russian Empire, then they lived under the Soviet Union, but at the same time, they had this kind of parallel self-governance structure where they kept their religion, their ways of doing things. And of course, that is the very interesting and terrible story of the Chechens once the Soviet Union falls apart and they try to make this parallel, this second layer, the real layer of Chechen society and bring it out into to make a state in Chechnya. So I suppose in the beginning, quite nearly a compassion for the difficult situation that the Chechens have lived under. And they are definitely kind of a punished people, historically speaking. But then gradually, the more you work with a conflict like that, you understand that there are always two sides to a conflict. And then with my PhD, really wanting to find out how conflicts come about. And also, I think, very much triggered by this very intense labeling of Chechnya as a terrorist threat during the Second Chechen War, and how it happened so quickly, and how suddenly everybody agreed that Chechnya was a terrible terrorist problem and that war was necessary. So that kind of took me up to what then became the basis of this book.
So could you please tell us about how you came to write this book? What got you interested in this problematic, and you know, how your research developed over the years of working on it?
Yeah, I was interested first in this quite empirical observation of the difference between the First and the Second Chechen War. Because during the First War, Russians came to reject the war. When they saw the misery that befell the Chechen population, there was a movement in Russian society against the war. When the Second Chechen War was launched, it was acceptable to the entire Russian population and the political elite. So that was the question I was interested in. How come that one war is unacceptable in the Russian polity, whereas one war becomes very acceptable? So, and the fact is that these two wars, in terms of cruelty towards the population, were just as stark. So my question is kind of how come that a war becomes acceptable? How does a war come to be seen as a necessary, even urgent and legitimate undertaking, even though the human suffering which happens when a war is undertaken is so gross? And my answer in the book is that this happens through a broad collective rephrasing, in this case of Chechnya, as an existential terrorist threat to Russia. And my main focus is on linguistic practices. So I'm interested in how this process of representing Chechnya as very dangerous, very different to Russia, then gradually creates this acceptance for a new war and for very heavy violence to be employed against Chechnya. And secondly, how these representations of Chechnya as different and dangerous kind of preclude other types of practices, such as negotiation, which, of course, is what happened during the First Chechen War. They were able to negotiate an end to the war with the Chechen separatists. So my argument is that this rephrasing process happens, of course, in language, in the way that we collectively speak about ourselves and others. So in the Russian case, in the Chechen case, how the Russians, in many layers of talk, talk about the Chechens and how they talk about themselves. And that this talk then creates the understanding of what Chechnya is. And a core point here is that this is not only talk. It has very, very dramatic consequences for the policies that can be pursued against this group of people, this piece of territory, or single members. And one example which I use throughout the book is the example of the Chechen president Maschadov, who in a certain period of time was spoken about as a reliable person, as somebody that the Russian leadership could do business with, cooperate with, but who then was killed in 2005 in a very brutal way, and he was interred in an unmarked grave as a terrorist. So I kind of follow how this figure, who's actually the only democratically elected president in Chechnya ever, how he is moved discursively from a position of some reliable partner to a terrorist through the way in which he is spoken about in Russian texts. So that's the key focus, is to show how an undertaking such as war is legitimized and made reasonable through these representations, these linguistic practices.
I see. And understand it correctly that your book is structured according to different types of texts. So you have a chapter on official representation, on historical representation, elite, expert, and journalistic. So are these chapters dedicated to the study of different kind of texts then?
Absolutely. And this is where I take my cue from securitization theory, Copenhagen School securitization theory. But I changed this theory because in securitization theory, the Speech Act, which sets off the securitization process, is portrayed as one single utterance, for example, by the political leadership. But in my reformulation of this theory, I say that securitization is a much, much broader social process. It is not grounded in one leader, but it is much more of a collective, intersubjective endeavor. And very many social actors take part. So in the book, I go through texts. I go through the texts of the Russian leadership during the core period of spring, summer, autumn 1999, and very carefully go through hundreds of texts and see what kind of representation of Chechnya was drawn by the Russian leadership at the time. And I find that it is a very frightening and very consistent image of Chechnya as an existential threat to Russia. Then I, in the next chapter, look into how Chechnya has been represented historically over time. And I find that in classical literature, Russian classical literature, of course, the Chechens have been portrayed as villains, as uncivilized, and brutal. I find that in the Soviet period, you have the same similar type of epithets attached to them, like terrorists, traitors, and so on. And also during the 1990s, the Chechens and Chechnya was portrayed as bandits, criminals, and so on. So the point of going through this genealogy of how Chechnya has been represented is to say that securitization of an issue doesn't happen in empty discursive space. It kind of, when, for example, Putin says that Chechnya is the center of international terrorism in the world, that resonates with representations in this broad discursive terrain, which actually goes many hundred years back in time. And then I move on to look at yet another set of texts, which is how Chechnya was spoken about and portrayed in the Russian Federal Assembly. Because it's often, and in fact, it's kind of an interesting observation to make in terms of how Russian politics are produced, because we often think that, you know, Putin sits on top and he decides everything. But what I discover when I go through the texts from the members of the Russian Federal Assembly is that the making of Chechnya as an existential terrorist threat to Russia is very much produced through the texts of the members of the Federal Assembly. In fact, very often their ways of talking about Chechnya is even harsher than what you find in the official text, in the text of the Russian leadership. And also their suggestions of what one should do to Chechnya are even more radical than the suggestions you find in the Russian leadership's text. So what I'm trying to say is that whereas Copenhagen School securitization theory would construe this as merely audience to the securitization, I'm trying to show that what we think about as audience is actually securitizers, meaning that these texts actually contribute to make Chechnya look like something very different and dangerous to Russia. And then in the next chapter, I look into what I call expert texts, which are texts by people like me, researchers, and how they talked about and portrayed Chechnya and the relationship between Chechnya and Russia in this period. And again, the quite astonishing finding is that these expert texts in Russia at that time are extremely politicized. And also, I tried to kind of look into how the authority which such people as experts bring with them in terms of historical and philosophical references and so on, how they really contribute to making Chechnya stand out as this existential threat towards Chechnya. And then in the final batch of texts I look into, that is journalistic texts. And that was, in a way, the most interesting aspect, because my initial idea was that, and that was an idea which emerged from knowing a lot about the first Chechen War, because one of the reasons why the first Chechen War was not successfully securitized and there was opposition against that war in Russia was that the media was portraying the misery of the Chechens, and the media was really painting a picture of the Chechens as fellow human beings. So my initial idea was to kind of try to pin down, you know, this was in 1999, so it was before strong media control in Russia. How did the media try to contradict, you know, the Putin leadership's images of the Chechens as terrorists, kind of. But what I found was, in fact, the opposite of what I expected. I found that the Russian media in this period was a core securitizing actor in the lingo of securitization theory. That really, if you, and I went through hundreds of newspaper articles, and then I searched for, you know, what kind of adjectives are linked to words such as Chechnya and Chechens, what kind of pictures were put in the paper when the war started, what kind of face were the Chechens left with if you sought to understand what Chechnya was through the pages of Russian newspapers. And the fact is that the Chechens are left with this terrorist face. There is hardly one picture in Russian newspapers describing Chechens merely as, you know, fellow citizens or human beings. Rather, the face of the Chechens as and Chechnya as terrorist is really detailed in Russian newspaper accounts by descriptions of cruelty, their cruelty, and at the same time by descriptions of Russia in a very different way from during the first war, This time around, Russia is without guilt, without blame. Russia is providing, you know, humanitarian aid. Russia is the good side, the Chechen side, and all parts of the Chechen separatist movement are terrorists. There is no distinguishing between the moderate camp or the radical fighters in Chechnya. So that was a final layer of text, which I looked through on the basis of this understanding that a process of securitization, making something stand out as a threat, as an existential threat to us, is not a single intentional event undertaken by one political leader. It's really a very broad social process, which then makes war seem acceptable to, in the Russian policy. Broadly speaking,
This is really an incredible narrative, and it is so surprising. So do you focus your inquiry on a specific period of time? Is it the interwar period?
I do. The first chapter, the first empirical chapter in the book, I make a kind of pilot study on the interwar period. And the reason why I do that is that in the interwar period between 1996 and 1999, really Chechnya is de-securitized as an issue in Russian discourse, at least if you look at the way they spoke about Chechnya on the top leadership level in Chechnya. So that's kind of a pilot and counter case to the rest of the book. So what I find in that period is a very, what I call a discourse on reconciliation. I go through the statements by the Russian leadership on Chechnya in this period, and I find that Chechnya is portrayed as a partner. Maskhadov is portrayed as a reliable person. And at the same time, when they speak about why the first Chechen war went so wrong, why everything became terrible, they speak about Russian guilt. So it's a very unusual way of speaking about Russian identity, but very typical for the 90s, that Russia is kind of portrayed as a weak entity, as a guilty entity, and Chechnya really as a partner and as a victim. So this way of talking about Chechnya enabled very different policies from the Kremlin towards Chechnya in this period. For example, all troops were pulled out of Chechnya. So no, you know, when Chechnya is a friend, you don't need to have 100,000 troops standing in that republic. And there was cooperation to establish, for example, common training of police. There were, of course, crucially the negotiations with Chechnya. So the claim is then that the desecuritization of Chechnya in this period made these practices of negotiation and cooperation possible. And then that kind of contrasts the rest of the empirical chapters, which are based on the period from 1999, where Chechnya is then rearticulated as this dangerous terrorist threat. Yes, and then in the final chapters of the book, I move into looking at the, as you would say in securitization theory, the emergency measures that this understanding of Chechnya as an existential terrorist threat enabled. And also there I try to give a contribution to Copenhagen School securitization theory, because in their setup they kind of state that when something is securitized, it enables, for example, the political leadership to move beyond the rules that otherwise bind and undertake emergency measures. But they don't really provide a theoretical explanation for what the link is. Whereas if you do a discourse theoretic reinterpretation of securitization theory, you can provide a link between the way the issue is securitized, the way it is talked about, how, in my case, how radical the representations of Chechnya were and the type of emergency measures that you are then able to undertake. So my claim and what I try to demonstrate in the final three chapters of the book is that the representation of Chechnya as very different and dangerous and as, you know, a terrorist threat which is capable of doing everything against us, that legitimizes the very brute use of force which Russia then undertakes against Chechnya from 1999 onwards. So I discussed that in three chapters. The first one is about, it is called Sealing Off Chechnya. And then I try to empirically document, you know, what actually happened, because that has really not been done in the case of the Chechen war. So I document the sealing off of Chechnya and also the sealing off of Chechens in Russian society. And then I try to document to some extent the all-out bombing of large parts of the republic, and which again, of course, reduced Grozny to rubble in 1999. And the third chapter is on the cleansing, what they call the cleansing of Chechnya. These were operations that affected the lives of nearly every single person in Chechnya and included practices such as massacres, torture, disappearances, and extrajudicial killings on a large scale. So I try to provide a rough overview over the scope of violence during the war. But my primary theoretical concern is to show that there is a link between how Chechnya and the Chechens were spoken about, how they came to be seen merely as terrorists and not humans, and how this seemed to make these very, very brute and violent practices necessary and legitimate to the Russian population. So that's I suppose, something which is also contribution to much of the discourse theoretic work, that very often you stop at analyzing language, whereas I really wanted to say that, you know, language matters. How we come to see certain groups as so different and dangerous to us, how that happens with language, but also how that is implemented in very concrete material practices, such as bombing, torture, and so on. So I try to explain the link between those two. And of course, that's not a causal link, but it is a claim that these representations and the kind of how radical these representations are, they stipulate not a particular type of action, but they make certain actions more logical and legitimate than others. So if you have branded someone a terrorist, it's more logical and legitimate to kill him than to negotiate with him. So that's what I'm trying to catch.
And of course, and you have already mentioned this, the representation of Chechens as fundamentally different, other, and threatening is very much in line with the portrayal in Russian classical literature. So I was wondering how the study of Pushkin, Lermontov, and Tolstoy fit into your research on security, and what did it contribute to your work?
Well, it contributes to the understanding of that these categorizations of the world are our way of seeing ourselves and other social objects in the world is, you know, builds on a genealogy of how these categories have presented over a long period of time. Therefore, it is, you know, there is such a thing as habitual enemies. And in the case of the Chechens, it is significant that they have had this status as different and dangerous in Russian literature for several hundred years. So what you find when you look at texts over time is that it's never a blue copy. It's never exactly the same representation, but that new representations build on old representations in some ways. So there will always be change, but there is always also continuity. So that's the interesting thing about looking further back into text, is that even these classical texts kind of feed into the securitization which goes on in 1999 and give kind of credibility to Putin's claim that Chechnya, or Yeltsin's claim actually, that Chechnya is the center of international terrorism, because it kind of is, oh yes, it's the Chechens again. So that's why it's important to look at how this enemy or friend is represented historically and further back in time, because it matters.
And as for the media, did you focus on the study of some specific media outlets?
Yeah, I did. I did Nezavisimaya Gazeta, and I actually did, because we have them here in paper from those years. So I actually did kind of day-to-day reading of Nezavisimaya Gazeta as well as Rossiyskaya Gazeta, which is kind of the official paper. But Nezavisimaya, because it was a paper which had really good and independent coverage of the First Chechen War. So that's why I chose that paper. And then in addition, I spent a lot of time searching actually across the Russian newspaper landscape in a specific database, which has collected a massive amount of newspaper articles from that time, searching, you know, just on the word Chechnya or terror or... So basically going through papers and quite broadly, I realized that it's when you want to understand how, you know, the guy in the street comes to see some group which he might not even have been in contact with ever in his life as different and dangerous and accepting that, yes, maybe a war is necessary to get rid of this threat, then it happens through the media, and it matters. The context of things matters. So the titles of the newspaper articles matter, the pictures matter, what kind of images are there together with the text. So that's something you can catch when you sit and just read and look into the every single issue of a newspaper, which you cannot if you use a more quantitative approach and just you get the whole context, which you wouldn't get in a quantitative approach where you just looked for, you know, certain words and not the entire text around that word.
And how, for example, does the work of Anna Politkovskaya fit in with your view on securitization?
Well, she, of course, does a very, she has a totally different approach. She's not an academician. She's a journalist. So you could say that her efforts to really show the crude violence and injustice of the Second Chechen War is in a way similar to what I do when I, in the last chapters of the book, try to document, you know, the extent of violence being undertaken during the Second Chechen War. But apart from that, of course, our approaches are very different. And really, when you work with discourse theory, you're very conscious that you're not trying to find out why things happen. So I'm not explaining why the Chechen War happened, but I'm explaining how it became acceptable. And of course, when you're a journalist, for example, you very often attribute intention to the actors that you study. When you do discourse theory, you are not interested in intention. And in fact, you're not so interested in actors as such. You're interested in how people talk about the world, in this case, how they talk about Chechnya and Chechens, what kind of representation, what kind of classifications that emerges from this talk and what the consequences are of this talk. So this is a fundamentally constructionist understanding of how the social world works. An agency is not, you know, pinned on an actor and what that actor intends to do. You are actually looking into the agency which lies in these discursive patterns. What happens when in all these different texts something is spoken about as difficult and dangerous? What happens is that we all think that it is legitimate to undertake security measures against this group or this piece of territory or whatever it is. So it's a very different focus in that way.
And you seem to make it very clear in your book that you want to distinguish between the discourse on war and the discourse on terrorism. And you bring up examples of how the war on terror actually legitimized various breaches of human rights. So could you elaborate a little more on your position about this?
Yeah, and I suppose that's also where I take my cue from securitization theory initially, because, I mean, one of their core points, Barry Bazan, Ole Wever, and Jacques de Ville, is that when something has been accepted as an existential threat to your security, then you can move beyond the rules that otherwise bind. This can be democratic rules, but they can also, of course, be rules like, you know, the human rights conventions, which all major states have signed, but which they easily set aside when something seems to be so dangerous that it poses an existential threat to us. So that is part of the securitization process. And in what I tried to explain earlier is that there is a kind of a scale of threat representations. And the more dangerous you make something look like, the more you will be able to break core rules, the more gross the violence you can employ against that subject becomes. So in the case of Chechnya, really, you know, the breaking of all the fundamental human rights which are enshrined in the Russian constitution from 1993 in such a gross fashion, which happened during the Second Chechen War, the ability to do that hinges on this understanding of the Chechen Republic, the entire Chechen Republic, in fact, merely as a terrorist threat. So this is kind of a slippery slope, of course, which many Western states is going down as well. But for Russia, it's particularly problematic because they have such, you know, the roots for keeping the human rights sacred are much weaker than in the Western context. So what I'm trying to show is also how really this terrorist discourse and this war on terror in Chechnya really set aside the respect for the human rights in Russia. And following on from that, you could say that this was the, in a way, the beginning of what we have seen throughout the Putin's time as a president, where it's easier and easier to break these rules of the game. And in fact, you know, from Chechnya is the most gross example of really breaching the core human rights of right to life, freedom from torture.
And how does your research apply to the broader war studies? And for example, Russia's involvement in Syria. Is there something, you know, that your research can help understand us about these political developments?
Yes, absolutely. And I say that in the beginning of my book, that, you know, this this particular case study is about how the Chechen War became acceptable in the Russian polity. But you can use the framework which I developed in the book to analyze how the intervention in Ukraine became a legitimate undertaking, how Russia operates in Syria. And the core point here is, of course, that any war is launched with a narrative of the other being a threat. So if you look into the Ukrainian case, then of course it was not the terrorist label which was attached to the new leadership in Kiev, but it was the Nazi or the fascist label which was attached to them to create this this distance between Russia and the new regime in Kiev, and to say that, you know, this is something dangerous and different from us. And of course, here again, the point of, you know, habitual enemies is very relevant, because if there's one another habitual enemy for Russia, it is the from the Second World War and the Nazis. So pinning this label on the Kiev regime really has resonance in the Russian polity. And then similarly, the reasoning and the attempts to legitimize the intervention in Syria, it's again the terrorists, of course, which you find if you look at, you know, the speeches of Putin, you find this refrain, and actually binding the narrative of the threat to the very specific Chechen situation within Russia, and then bringing it down to Syria and saying this is the same very dangerous evil threat we're facing in Syria, and even saying it's better to, you know, to kill off the terrorists in Syria than to have them come back home. So my claim is that the framework which I develop in the book really is useful for understanding how war becomes a legitimate undertaking in Russia. And then, of course, there's a difference in the sense that the media sphere looks different today than it did in 1999 in Russia, because it was at that point where the Chechen War happened, the media was still quite free to write what they want. At the same time, I think it's important to say that, and we seem sometimes to think that it's Putin alone who does all this, and that is not true. Because if you look into the way they talk in the Duma or in the Federation Council, you find that the securitization of the Ukrainian threat, let's say, is very much a collective endeavor. It's not only the Russian leadership. It has a much broader basis in Russian society. So in this sense, I think the framework which I developed is quite relevant for understanding when Russia goes to war, whether it's in Chechnya or in Ukraine or in Syria.
Well, Julie, this has been an incredibly interesting interview, and thank you for giving me so much of your time. Before we say goodbye, I wanted to ask our last traditional question, and that is, what are you working on right now? What have you been up to after Russia's securitization of Chechnya?
I'm working on several different things, as we have to when you work in a research institute such as NUPI. So I have been doing some work on trying to explain the very tight relation between Putin and Ramzan Kadyrov, who's today the head of Chechnya, as a kinship relation. How the link between the Russian ruler and Chechnya today is made up of very personal kinship style relation between those two people. So that's one thing I've been working on. And then secondly, working on now, a study on Russia-Western interaction in the war on Syria, taking as a point of departure that Putin invited at the General Assembly in 2015, invited to a into a broad coalition to fight international terrorism in Syria, and then asking the question, why? And actually, the US leadership responded fairly positively, saying that, you know, that this could be possible. So the question we're asking in this piece of research is, why did it not succeed? And our model is kind of builds on the same discourse, theoretic, social understanding of how politics works. So we're trying to say that even if there is an expressed intent to cooperate in Syria at this specific point in time, the leadership, both in Russia and on the Western side, have these very ingrained enemy images of each other. So Russia looks upon the West with its NATO expansions, its color revolutions and so on as a threat to its security. And the West, in particular the US maybe, is projecting Russia, since the annexation of Crimea, is projecting Russia as a threat to the US. So that's one point we make, but this is a difficult starting point. And it matters when states want to collaborate, how they look upon each other, what kind of image they have. Is this a friend or is it a foe? And then we also look into the what we call the domestic debates, and how the internal choir of voices inside the US as well as inside Russia, how they speak about the other state, and how this domestic debate impinges on and makes it really difficult for the top leadership to negotiate. And what we find, of course, that when Russia is portrayed as a liar, as a cheat, and increasingly so as the American election campaign rolled on, the more difficult it is actually for Obama and Kerry to negotiate with Russia, because it's like negotiating with the devil if you have this type of domestic debate. And it's the same on the Russian side, when the Russian leadership has, in a way, aroused this understanding of the West as a threat. These representations of the West, they keep reappearing in the Russian domestic debate, and it makes it and the Russian leadership constantly harks back to these representations of the West as somebody you can't rely on, that actually are not willing to negotiate in Syria, but instead want to arm the opposition against Assad and so on. So we're trying to kind of pin down this social game, which makes it really difficult to collaborate on a specific task, such as fighting international terrorism in Syria, even if, you know, there's a stated interest in actually collaborating at the beginning. So we're showing how, and of course it all came apart this autumn, that the negotiations to collaborate, they came apart. They did not happen. Instead, it was Russia together with Iran and Turkey who have now been negotiating so-called a peace solution to the Syria crisis in Astana, and the US isn't even part of the negotiation. So that's what I'm working on now.
That sounds really fascinating, and I'm wishing you the best of luck with this, well, interesting project. And thank you a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much for asking me to present my book.
Good luck, Julie, and goodbye.
So this was my conversation with Julie Wilhansen, author of the book Russia's Securitization of Chechnya, How War Became Acceptable. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and please stay tuned for more episodes of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. Until then, this was your host, Olga Breininger, and take care.